Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkar, and more importantly, I have the pleasure today of welcoming back to the podcast, Dr. Peter Scharf, to speak about a really fascinating and useful new resource, a second edition, a new edition of the Ramopakhyana, the story of Rama in the Mahabharata. It's the subtitle of the work is An Independent Study Reader in Sanskrit. Welcome back to the podcast, Peter.
Thank you. Glad to be back. Yes, and so this is it's a new edition, not only of the Independent Study Reader in Sanskrit, but I designed it so that it would be more amenable to people in India as well. So much of the text that I had in Roman transliteration in the original edition, I reproduced the edition in the same format, but I also made an edition with all of the Sanskrit in Devanagari script rather than having Romanization. So in that version, only the Roman transliteration of the verse is in Roman script, but the Sandhi analysis and the glossary and the notes and everything else has all the Sanskrit in Devanagari script, including in the introduction.
And so who would you think would most benefit in terms of the audience aimed at? Is this particularly for those who are learning Sanskrit or at a particular level, or what would you say?
So the independent study readers are geared for someone who wants to learn Sanskrit. So they're meant for somebody who has studied some Sanskrit before. They should have completed, for example, a first year university course in Sanskrit, or they've had Sanskrit in grade school, or some good start on reading Sanskrit, because this is not a text which is an introductory Sanskrit textbook. I have another book, which I think we haven't talked about actually, which is in Linguistic Introduction to Sanskrit. It's a first year Sanskrit textbook. But this is meant for students who have completed that kind of book, whether that particular one or somebody else's, and is meant for their continued independent study. But it also can be used even while someone is learning, because, for example, just to practice reading the Devanagari script, they have the transliteration there. To practice analyzing Sandhi, they have the Sandhi analysis there. And they have a glossary there, so it helps them learn vocabulary. And for more advanced students who have actually completed a first year Sanskrit class, there are prose sentences which give the anvaya of the verse and sometimes give a simple summary of what the verse says in Sanskrit. And those are good practice for someone who has already completed the first year Sanskrit course and wants some new text to read, but it's based on the same story. And I also give some grammatical notes and an English translation there. So in addition to this independent study reader in Sanskrit in the original version with a lot of the material Romanized, and in the completely Devanagari edition, the one that has all the Sanskrit and Devanagari, I also created a version where I just give the English translation. The English translation and the general introduction. And this is meant for a broader audience. This is meant for people who just want to read about the Ramayana, but they don't want to read the full text of the Valmiki Ramayana. They'd like a genuine introduction to the story, not somebody's modern retelling, but an exact translation of the text as the story is told in the Mahabharata. So there are Rama figures in the Mahabharata which are not Rama of Ayodhya. They're somebody else. But Parashurama, for example. But this is not about Parashurama. This is about Rama, the Rama of Ayodhya, the ancient king whose brother was Lakshman and Bharata and Shatrughna, and who was married to Sita. It's the same story, but it's told in the Mahabharata in about 700 verses, which is approximately the length of the Bhagavad Gita. So someone can read that. It just comes to the entire book is about 150 pages long, and I give the general introduction with some analysis of the story and interpretation of the story on different levels.
Yes,
so that's meant for people in a general literature class, for example, in colleges, or for a general reader.
Absolutely, and for those who are learning Sanskrit, it's useful to have, as you say, something to work with that isn't engineered. It's extant. It's living in a sense, in that it's still in use, and it's a sort of an authentic part of tradition and a very popular story. And so it makes for a really nice unit to dive into. I remember when I discovered your grammar books some years ago. I think I was preparing for, I was teaching at a platform somewhere, and I remember, you know, that's a really that's a great angle theme, you know, the story of Rama, but as in Mahabharata, we're not looking at, you know, the seven khandas of the Valmiki Ramayana, which obviously would be overwhelming,
right? It's 25,000 lines, 25,000 verses.
How much preparation, or, you know, however you want to put it, how many years of Sanskrit or exposure do you think one would need to grapple with the Ramapakyana?
A year is enough. That is a year of a rigorous university level Sanskrit class. But I know that some professors have used the Ramapakyana as a textbook in their second year classes. And some have introduced it towards the end of a first-year class. So after they've completed a survey of the grammar would be the best time. But as I mentioned, it can be used even earlier as a method to practice the first stages of learning Sanskrit. So one can, you know, read the verses in Devanagari, and one can check to see whether one reads Devanagari script correctly by reading the Roman transliteration there. So all of the steps of learning Sanskrit can also be practiced with the Ramapakyana.
How did this interest or this idea come about? How were you first exposed to this, or whereby did it dawn on you to render this as the basis of a grammar book?
Yeah, I was teaching Sanskrit at Brown University, and after a couple of years of teaching, I decided to create my own teaching materials. I wasn't satisfied with the first year Sanskrit text, or with the so at that time the only second year text available was Lahnman's Reader, and the notes in there are not complete. So very often it's not enough, and sometimes it's too much, but. But when it's not enough, it's a problem, and then one has to go to a general dictionary or a grammar text, and sometimes that can be overwhelming for the second year student. So I decided what really should be available is something which is completely thorough. It gives all the information necessary to understand a verse. If someone doesn't want to look at it all, they can skip it, but all of that information should be available for a complete and thorough understanding of every aspect of the verse. And so that's when I decided I would create that. I had originally seen something which I myself, you know, I had used myself, Winthrop Sargent's edition of the Bhagavad Gita. And I had seen also the publications of Upanishads put out by the Vedanta Society in Southern California, which give word for word translations of every word in the passage. And Winthrop Sargent's edition of the Bhagavad Gita gives some identification and a translation. But there also I felt, well, they're giving more information. And I found Sargent's edition very helpful in reading the Bhagavad Gita. And after using that, that was really the inspiration for me to create this. But I thought I can do it even better and more thoroughly than he had prepared his Gita edition. But I wanted to do it with some other text. So I chose the Rama Upakhyana. I thought it would second most popular story in India besides the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably Goldman in one of his intro essays famously says, or maybe Sheldon Pollack, one of the two, I think in one of the first two khandas of the critical edition translation project, they note that, you know, literally, historically, more people have known the story of Rama than the story of Moses. Like, literally, this is a popular, yes, pervasive story that is endlessly captivating. Still, there's something charming and fascinating and bizarrely endlessly relevant about this this ancient Indic hero's journey. You know, in my particular case, I love language, I love literature, I love looking at, for example, the Rama Upakhyana, and then questions that would come to my mind is, you know, why is it in the Mahabharata? Why does Markandeya speak it? What's going on here? And, yeah, you know, I love Sanskrit in a way that's not dissimilar from the way in which I love English, in that it's sort of the expression and the fluidity of the language, but I certainly wouldn't be competent or I could be competent actually, but I wouldn't, you know, teaching grammar and understanding grammar isn't where my mind gravitates towards. And so, maybe tell us about a little bit about your journey with grammar and Sanskrit grammar. And was that always sort of, you know, where you lived with the language or a natural strength of yours? And maybe if you can dovetail that into, you know, what advice would you give for folks who would like to begin Sanskrit or have already begun in terms of strategies or resources or any of that stuff?
Well, my own journey began when I was 15 years old. I was taught transcendental meditation by my brother, and that was my first exposure to Sanskrit in the small ceremony where one is taught transcendental meditation. The teacher recites a puja to Gurudeva, the teacher of Maharshi Mahesh Yogi, Swami Brahmananda Saraswati. So that was my first exposure to Sanskrit, and so I was always curious about the background of DM and Indian philosophy, and so, you know, I started reading the Upanishads when I was in college, just on the side, and I never not in a class, but in my own pleasure reading, and I was thinking about studying Sanskrit, but it wasn't offered in my university. So I decided I would study ancient Greek, classical Greek, which also has a strong philosophical tradition. And I was very interested in Plato and Socrates. So I had learned ancient Greek before I went to graduate school. And it's in graduate school where I started studying Sanskrit. And and there I was really appalled at the fact that the approach was only written. I mean, there was no emphasis on the spoken language at all. And with Sanskrit, which has a living tradition up to today, there's no reason for that. It's not as dead as Latin or Greek is.
And it's which, a beautiful, beyond the living nature of it, it's literally crafted for, you know, on some level, acoustic enjoyment, if not felicity in the mouth, like fluidity in the mouth. And so it, the very language has so many features that are geared towards utterance. And so all the more so, I think, yes, a travesty with Sanskrit.
Yeah. Most linguists think that language is entirely conventional and they don't think that any one language is better than another. However, if you ask a musician, you know, a choral singer, what they'd rather sing, Latin or German, and there's no question that, you know, Latin is more beautiful. Latin, you know, Italian, these languages have the purer vowels, They don't have nasalized as an eh, you know, eh. These sounds aren't there. And Sanskrit has very pure vowels, okay? Ah, e, u, a, o, very pure vowels. And ancient features of those sounds, like the distinction between length, which is absent in English, for example. We don't distinguish between the length of vowels. So these are actually features of the language, which are, I think, qualitatively more beautiful and may actually have different effects, different physiological effects on the nervous system, actually. So there is something to that, that, you know, some languages may actually be better than others. But besides that, the real motivation for me is that Sanskrit has an abundance of literature, and not just an abundance. Okay, it's the language with the largest body of literature in the world prior to the printing press. And not only in abundance, but the descriptions in Sanskrit of something that particularly interested me was the philosophical texts and the philosophical and scientific understanding of consciousness and the development of consciousness is more precise and more extensive in Sanskrit than in any other language, in any other literature of the world. And so this is a real treasure of Sanskrit. And I think now, in this age, when quantum mechanics is on the verge of recognizing that consciousness needs to be brought into the equation of understanding the universe, we can recognize the importance of traditions in India, like Vedanta, the Vedanta tradition, which recognized consciousness as the fundamental element of the universe. And this is a feature of Sanskrit and Sanskrit literature, but it's also a feature of some of the stories in the Indian tradition. The stories in Indian tradition often have a deliberate metaphorical resonance with these philosophical ideas. And this is what I bring out in my introduction to the Ramopakhyana. So In that introduction, I mentioned there are several different interpretations of the story. One can interpret the story on different levels. So that many people today are confused, actually, about what level the story of Rama is being told on. Is it a narration of historical facts? And some people will take offense if you say no to that question, right? They'll say, is it just fiction that somebody made up? People will take great offense at that, right? Because Rama is seen as somebody real. So, but Rama is also not just a person in historical time, but he's also the incarnation of Vishnu in that story, right? So then there's a divine story which is going on simultaneously with the narration of what seems to be an historical event. And then there's more to it. There's a more abstract level on which the story is told, which is that Rama, as an incarnation of, let's say, the Paramapurusha, the supreme being, or pure consciousness itself in human form, and Sita as someone who is born from the earth. I mean, after all, Sita, the name Sita is, and the story tells us, is she's discovered in a field, in a furrow, which is what Sita means, by Janaka, and adopted. So Sita is a representative of the earth. And in the Uttara Ramayana, in Valmiki's Uttara Ramayana, Sita descends again into the earth, taken on the lap of her mother earth. So obviously, there's an intention there to make Sita as a representative of Prakriti. So you've got Purusha represented in Rama and Sita represented in Prakriti, which is the Sankhya narration of the basic elements of the world. So then it shows Sita at the end of the Uttara Ramayana descending back into the earth, which means means Prakriti is undergoing what's called pratiprasava, the enfoldment back into the more basic and constituent elements of nature and into the unmanifest, leaving Purusha in a state of kaivalya or enlightenment.
It's certainly a fascinating tale. And one of the things I say in many teaching contexts, continuing studies, but in more spiritual contexts, is that, you know, people are caught up with the idea of whether the story is historically true, but mythological stories, and to my mind, mythological is not a dirty word. Myth is not a four-letter word in the way some people think it might be. They're emotionally true. They're spiritually true. You don't need any more evidence in this that look at the great mythological blockbusters that just utterly move and engross and grip people. You know, mythological stories are true in a sense that perhaps transcends, you know, their historical veracity or such considerations. But I sort of see what you mean in terms of the various levels in which you can interpret the story. And clearly it's a story that's captivated your interest like so many before you, and it makes for a good fit in that it's relatively, as you say, with a solid first year of Sanskrit, you can get through most of the story without too much trouble. Now let's circle back to you know, what strategies, what do you wish you could tell your younger self learning Sanskrit, or others who are learning Sanskrit now? What are some strategies or tools or advice that you might be able to offer?
Well, in the past year or so, I have developed an online exercise platform that allows students to learn in a way that is more enjoyable and more effective. Actually, so when I taught Sanskrit at Brown University, you know, I would assign a set of 30 sentences to a student, and it would take them you know, a few days to work through that. And in the process of working through that, they might have some confusion, they might make some mistake, and they would repeat the same mistake in many of the sentences of the homework set. And then they would come to class and hand those sentences in, and I would take them home and correct them in detail. We'd go over some of them in class, but most of the corrections I would do afterwards at home, and then give them back maybe a week later after the student has done them. By that time, they've already started a second set of exercises and are again repeating the same errors. So this is very inefficient, extremely inefficient, and it's extremely tedious for a teacher to correct the same error over and over again. So so the mechanical errors, like transliteration of Devanagari script into Romanization, the analysis of Sandhi and the morphological identification of forms, all this is extremely tedious, but it has to be learned exactly to understand Sanskrit. And there's a better way to do it than allowing a week to pass before the teacher can correct it. So I designed this online exercise platform that addresses those questions immediately and gives the student pointed information about exactly where the error is, with links to help that helps them understand the issue and correct it themselves immediately before they go on to the second sentence. So it's much more efficient and much more pleasurable. That's one of the main reasons I developed it. It's an extremely useful resource, and we use it in our classes here at the Sanskrit Library. Sanskrit Library offers introductory Sanskrit classes during the year and intensive Sanskrit classes during the summer, as well as advanced Sanskrit classes.
Great. We'll certainly put the link to your Sanskrit Library in the podcast notes for those who may be interested in checking it out and learning through that platform. Was there anything else about this project or the work or Sanskrit or learning Sanskrit that you wanted to touch on today?
So one thing that we touched on briefly, but that we didn't elaborate on is, you know, why is it in the Mahabharata? Why is the story of Rama in the Mahabharata, and how does it come up?
Tell me more.
So so the scene is that Jayadratha abducts Draupadi and goes running off. And Arjuna and Bhishma come chasing after him. And, you know, within a short period of time, they catch up to him and, you know, punish him by shaving his head. But they get Draupadi back, and then they're back in their camp in the forest. And Markandeya comes there, and Yudhishthira asks Markandeya, you know, we got Draupadi back, but the fact is she was abducted. So, you know, why did this sorrowful event happen to us? And he then asks, particularly, I'll read you my translation. You know, Janamejaya is the narrator at this point. He says, after they became severely afflicted because Krishna is the name for the proper name of Draupadi. Draupadi is her patronymic as the daughter of Drupada. Because Krishna had been abducted in this way, what did the tiger-like sons of Pandu do next? And then Vaishampayana answers Janamejaya's question. Janamejaya is the king conducting a snake sacrifice, and Vaishampayana comes there with his students, and he narrates the story after Janamejaya stops his snake rite. Vaishampayana says, after he liberated Krishna and conquered Jayadratha in this way, Yudhishthira, the king Dharma, sat with multitudes of seers. In the middle of those seers, listening and commiserating, the delighter of Pandu, Yudhishthira, spoke this speech to Markandeya. And he goes on a little bit, and then he says, you know, how could such an occurrence touch of her being abducted? Touch our Dharma-knowing, Dharma-practicing wife, just like an undeserved theft touches a pure man. For the daughter of Draupadi, the daughter of Drupada, Krishna, did not do any evil or action censured anywhere. Always among Brahmins, she properly carried out the great Dharma. And the dull-witted Jayadratha forcibly abducted her. Because of abducting her, he got his head shaved and got defeated in battle with his companions. Thus, we took her back after slaying that army of Sindhu. But undisputedly, we did get our wife abducted. So then, you know, he then asks, is there now any man less fortunate than I, one you might have seen before or even heard of before? And then Markandeya says, yeah, there was Rama. Rama had his wife abducted. So that's that's the context. Yeah.
No matter how many times I hear that prompt, it's just as rich, pun intended, each time. That the setup is so comical, but telling, you know, woe is me. Has anybody had it worse than me? Oh, yeah. I have this tale of this dude named Rama.
Yeah.
I mean, it right. seems so tongue-in-cheek the Mahabharata would set it up this way, because certainly all of the audience of the architects and the audience of the Mahabharata itself would be well aware of the story of Rama. And to have them set it up this way seems very playful to my mind.
Yeah, I think so. And these stories are inserted in the story of the Mahabharata, which got expanded over the centuries after orally being handed down to include many other things. But then he wraps it up at the end, you know, after telling the story. He comes back to the situation of Yudhishthira in the forest and tells him, you know, look, you know, Rama conquered his enemies and got his wife back. Even though he was, you know, alone in the forest there. And how did he do it? He did it with friends and allies. And he said, think about it. Okay. And then immediately after this, what does Yudhishthira do? He starts acquiring allies for the battle. So it's a lesson also, besides just being an incidence of, you know, answering who could be worse off. But it's a lesson that tells him to acquire allies, because after all, Rama acquired the ally of Sugriva and his army to help him in the battle with Ravana.
Absolutely.
So Yudhishthira also then has to collect allies for his battle with Duryodhana.
Well, it's rich on so many levels because so often the narratives themselves encode with them or explicitly contain suggestions on how to relate to the narratives, right? So just as it's not just once upon a time, it's so-and-so has a question. So-and-so is in a situation. They ask a question and then the story is told, which within the story world of the text is inviting us to relate to these texts in this way. You know, what are your questions? You know, how do these apply to life? Right? Whom are you approaching to tell these tales? And so I just find it, I find frame narratives endlessly fascinating in this context in terms of exerting influence on exegesis.
Yeah. And another, a really beautiful aspect of the story of Rama is his relationship with his brothers. And this is another reason why it's fascinating that it's put in the Mahabharata, because it shows the contrast with the behavior of the dispute between the Pandavas and the Dhritarashtras, the children of Dhritarashtra, who can't get along with each other. But Rama and his brothers have such a tight bond with each other that even when he's banished to the forest, just as Yudhishthira got banished to the forest with the Pandava brothers, Bharata, who's back in the kingdom, unlike Duryodhana, isn't interested in taking over the kingdom. He rules the kingdom in Rama's name. He tries to bring Rama back from the forest and welcomes Rama back and coronates him king when he returns victorious. So there's such a love and devotion between the brothers, Rama and Lakshman, Bharata and Shatrughna, that is paradigmatic and really sets an example for human life.
Indeed. Fascinating. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today and discussing your Ramupakana work.
Thank you, Raj. As always, it's a pleasure.
For those listening, of course, we've been speaking with Dr. Peter Scharf on this new very valuable edition of the Ramupakana, the story of Rama in the Mahabharata, an independent study reader in Sanskrit. All the links for the resources and the learning platform are in the podcast notes. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the career of Rama. Take care.